Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we kick off a new series on criminal justice reform. We begin by discussing rehabilitation and why it matters with the co-founders of Oakland-based Restore Justice. In 2018, Restore Justice successfully sponsored legislation known as Senate Bill 1437, which revised the felony murder rule. That was with the help of Berkeley State Senator Nancy Skinner. Despite being a relatively new organization, Restore Justice is already proving to be a remarkably effective agent of change. Our first guest is Adnan Khan, who co-founded Restore Justice while incarcerated at San Quentin Prison. He was also the first incarcerated person released after SB 1437 passed, after 16 years of incarceration. He was freed on January 18, 2019. He now continues his work with Restore Justice from outside prison, and you might also know him from the podcast Ear Hustle. We're also joined by Adnan's co-founder, Alex Malik, who is currently the executive director of Restore Justice. Prior to founding the organization, she worked at Human Rights Watch as an associate director in the Bay Area. She's also a board member for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. So I want to welcome our guests, Adnan Khan and Alex Malik, to City Visions.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, in about 20 minutes. We'll invite you to join our conversation by phone. Here's that number now, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send your questions or comments by email at cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Adnan, I wanted to start with you. You were in prison, as I mentioned, for almost 16 years and were just released in January. Explain to our listeners how it was that you came to be released and why that wasn't something that you thought would be possible when you first entered prison.
I mean, when I first entered prison, I could start from there. I was fighting a 25-to-life sentence, and I was 18 years old when I committed my crime and when I came into jail. And so once I was given 25-to-life, I pretty much thought that my life was over. And how does a 18, 19, 20-year-old look 25 years ahead on a maximum security level 4 prison? And so for me, going home was not a possibility. My first day on a maximum security prison, I literally have my linen in my hand, walk into a cell, and there's this big 6'3" Samoan guy, a gang member from Los Angeles. He said, the prison is on lockdown. And I said, why? He said, that's because somebody was murdered in the chapel. Like, that's the first minute of my 25-to-life experience. And so, do I think I'm going home? Home is not a thought right now. Survival is.
Mm. And so then fast forward to when you found out that there was a possibility that you actually might be able to leave prison. How did that come about?
So that just came about recently. In about a year, I want to say, a year ago, it was not so much a possibility. The possibility actually happened earlier this year, which 45 days. I've been out 45 days after serving 16 years. And so when Alex and I were in San Quentin, while I was doing time, she was volunteering. And that's when Restore Justice, our nonprofit, we co-founded. And the idea of 1437, which is the Senate bill of the felony murder bill, came to be. And so we slowly pushed it. I don't want to bore you with the logistics, but it was very, very suspenseful. It lasted about a year to get it through the Senate, the different committees in the Senate, then get it through the Assembly. And finally, in August, it passed. The bill passed, which told me that, wow, I actually may have a chance to go home now. And that really happened for me in August, but it was still unbelievable. It was literally unbelievable until the moment the judge on January 18th told me, hey, you're walking out. I'm releasing you today.
Wow. Wow. And what was that like for you when he said that, or she said that?
Yeah, it was a she. So what's interesting is I sat in the courtroom. I was called from county jail. From state prison. So it's a different jurisdiction. When you're in a state prison, it's a different jurisdiction from being in county jail. And so the county deputies had to come pick me up from San Quentin. And so 12:40 in the morning, an officer wakes me up in prison, and he says, pack all your stuff, 16 years worth of stuff. Here's two trash bags, and you're going to county jail. And I told him, hey, man, this is a mistake. I don't know why I'm going there. I'm not supposed to go there. Can you call your superior, your sergeant, your lieutenant, and tell him that I refuse? I don't want to go back to county jail because I know how inhumane and unsanitary it is. And just let alone leave my quote-unquote comfort of being where I was already established. And so I finally get to where I'm going in county jail. I walk into the courtroom. I see that the judge walks in. This is the judge that sentenced me to 25 to life. So I saw her for 4 years. I was in county jail for 4 years fighting my case from 18 to almost 22 to 22 years old. And so when she walks in, it was weird seeing her because last time I saw her, I was a young man, you know, young 20-year-old, 21-year-old. And she walks in, she sits down, and before she actually came in, just real briefly, I turned to my attorney, and the first thing I asked my attorney was, hey, is the family, the victim's family here? The reason I asked that, like, I didn't want to re-victimize or harm them in any way. Like, if they saw me or if I were to say something, if they were to ask me anything, to even my voice, to re-victimize them. So I was very concerned about that. My attorney advised me that they were not here. And so my next question was, okay, as soon as this is over, can you please send me back to San Quentin? Please, as soon as this little rescheduling hearing's over, that's what I thought it was. I was there for the judge to set a date, to set another date, to set another date. That's what I thought I was there for. Anyway, so that's what I'm telling my attorney. As soon as this is over, please send me back to San Quentin. I'm like, hey, the Super Bowl's coming up, right? I want to watch the Super Bowl in the comfort of my cell. And so that's what I was worried about. So when she walks in, she says, the judge, she says, hey, Mr. Khan, I've looked at the new legislation. I've looked at the new the law that was passed. I looked at your case. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to resentence you to 3 years. You've done five times that amount, and I'll be releasing you today. Like, that's it.
That was it.
And so I sat there numb. I definitely heard what she said. I mean, I was conscious, but I was numb. Goosebumps, nerves, tears. Like, I just, everything, all at one time. I never felt that emotion before. It was all emotions in one. And there was disbelief, even though I heard it. Like, what, you're telling me? I thought I was going back to San... My whole thing was, I want to go back to San Quentin and watch the Super Bowl. You're telling me that I'm walking home in an hour? And that was that.
Wow. So that's the end of your incarceration, not obviously the end of the story, but we're starting with the end. But Alex, I want to bring you in here to tell us a little bit in more detail about SB 1437 and how that applied to Adnan and to others, and why you and others were so insistent that this legislation be passed.
Sure. So SB 1437, as you said, it amended the felony murder rule. Actually, I came to know and learn about the felony murder rule, I'm not an attorney, by meeting Adnan at San Quentin State Prison when I was a volunteer. And basically, the felony murder rule is an ancient law that comes from the medieval times in England. And it basically means that if you're involved in an underlying felony, the most common being burglary or robbery, and if a murder occurs, even if you had nothing to do with the murder during that burglary or robbery, then every single person who's involved in that underlying felony is guilty of murder. So when I heard Adnan's story, I felt like it was an incredible injustice. And another thing that I found is that so many people who were sentenced to life as teenagers were convicted under this felony murder rule, and they really had little chance of coming home. And I thought it was a real injustice. So what I did was I tried to find attorneys and people who could help overturn this law. And that's when we met our other co-founder, Kate Chatfield, a brilliant attorney who wrote and designed this law. And she added the retroactive piece, the piece that brought people home, which makes it such a unique piece of legislation, because most legislation is prospective, meaning it only stops the problem right away. It doesn't reach into prisons and bring people out, which is what's really, really needed in criminal justice reform. We need to be brave, and we need to, if a law is unjust, it was unjust today, it was unjust yesterday. Mm. That's what we always reminded people.
So the passage of this of bill and being signed into law by former Governor Brown was about decoupling the fact that if someone was involved in a felony that happened to also result in murder, that it it separated out who was truly responsible for the murder.
Exactly. It was all about intent. If someone's intent, they should be punished for their intent. So if you are, for example, the getaway driver in a robbery and you're unarmed and there's a struggle inside of, let's say, the 7-Eleven that you have nothing to do with, you should certainly not be convicted of a murder you did not commit. And we found through our research and through our work on this law that it disproportionately affects women. 72% of women were convicted under the felony murder rule. We're actually not the killers. We're not the murderers. And we also found that it affected young people because teenagers do things in packs. And also, obviously, people of color.
And so say more about that. Say more how much of this was part of the argument. It sounded like you felt like there was an injustice being served upon people for being held accountable for an act that they did not commit. But then you felt like actually that aspect also disproportionately affected youth, women, and people of color. Say more about how that became part of the talking points, the argument to getting this to the place it got to.
Well, we did surveys in all California prisons. There's 35 prisons in California, and so we sent surveys with help of really wonderful organizations and volunteers throughout the state, and that's how we got our figures. And we knew a lot of people inside prisons. Well, the way that this came about, well, district attorneys, they have complete power over how to prosecute people. So they're the ones who charge people. So they can decide whether to not charge someone at all or charge them with first-degree murder. So in many cases, there is that bias, and they will decide to charge that young person of color versus a young white child or a teenager who's done the exact same thing. And we've seen that a lot.
Mm. Do you have a sense of, in those numbers, what's the estimate of people who are currently serving sentences in California state prisons that this rule change may apply to?
Well, from our research, we said about 800. 800 people. We think it'll be about 800 to 2,000 people.
Okay. And Adnan, you were the first person released under this rule change. Do you know of anyone else who's been released since you?
I personally do not know, but there's this new thing. It didn't exist when I was out there. It's called Facebook. And so, and Instagram,
right.
These
That's
crazy
right.
kids are doing now.
Right.
And so, kind of learning that and watching how the world moves through that.
There's no internet access.
There
for
is
people.
No internet access. Right. I mean, when I first went in prison, like they didn't even have cameras on phones yet.
Mm.
You know, right. And I remember people talking about it, right? And I don't want to go into a tangent, but real briefly, people are like, they're going to put cameras on phones. And I remember the conversation was like, why would people want to put cameras on phones? That is so stupid. That was like the last conversation I recall having before I was incarcerated. And so now, like, I get why, first of all. And not only do they have cameras, they have video cameras on phones, which is amazing. And so through that, I've been able to watch men and women get released under 1437. And I press that little thumbs up guy, mm-hmm. make sure I like all of them. You know?
Right. So, Alex, before we delve in a little bit more to Adnan's story so that we can also understand the importance of rehabilitation, which is really the work that you're both trying to do and promote, I want to also set the stage about where we are as a state and as a nation when it comes to people thinking about criminal justice reform. Where do you think we are as a country and as a state, and why do you feel like if things are changing, why is that happening now?
Well, I think we have a long way to go. I think that while California is incredibly progressive, we still have a lot of progress to make. I think that, and I've been enthusiastic over legislation that passes this year, this in 2018 in California, and I think that the passing of SB 1437, our felony murder rule legislation, really helped change the dialogue because we're talking about. And especially with at Restore Justice, we really believe in talking about issues around violence. And if you don't talk about violence and you're not and you're too afraid to find solutions around how to deal with violence, how to sentence people who've committed violence, then we're not going to really even solve mass incarceration at all. So I feel like in the past there was this discussion and this really this separation between violent and nonviolent. And I think that finally, after a really long time, people are finally getting it that you have to discuss issues of violence in order to solve this mass incarceration crisis.
Mm. So, can I add something real briefly? Yeah. I think one thing that I do get afraid of when we're talking about mass incarceration and this conversation with violence is kind of like the situation that happened with the felony murder bill. And the felony murder bill really, I think it was very fair. I also hold myself very much accountable for what I did to come to prison. And also want to add to that that a lot of conversation has been towards the non-killer in the crime, the person who did not commit the murder. And so according to this law, that was unjust. But I also want to say that we need to have more conversation around people who have done violent crimes. And there's a big narrative around people, there's violent criminals. Well, I will say that I committed a crime in the past does not mean that I'm a criminal today. If I've done an act of violence in the past does not mean that I'm violent 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years later. And so conversation around violence, people who have committed violence, we need to be more open to that.
So you're saying that whereas 1437 was perhaps able to pass through because people could make a distinction between violent and nonviolent crime, we can't forget people who have committed violent crimes and what reform needs to be done.
Absolutely. And I think what this 1437, the Senate bill, did was kind of like maybe open a crack in the door, maybe. Mm-hmm. And these are my words. I don't speak for the public. But put a crack in the door where maybe this conversation continues to be had. Mm-hmm. I just read something earlier with Michelle Alexander was talking about the very same thing. She authored The New Jim Crow. And she was talking about, if I'm getting the statistics right, over 50% of people in state prisons are in there for committing an act of violence in the past. Mm-hmm. And so if we're talking about, like Alex just said, if we're talking about mass incarceration, we need to understand what that really means. Why do people commit violence? Mm-hmm. You know, and who they are 5, 10, 15, 20. I mean, let me ask you, are you the same person you were 3 years mm-hmm. ago, mm-hmm. 5 years ago? Are you the same person you were 10 years ago? You know, are you the same person you were at 18? And most people would say no. And so we need to start having that conversation. And then have that conversation about understanding healing and rehabilitation is something where I think we're going to get into a little bit later.
So if it's okay with you, I wanted to sort of go back to the beginning. Remember,
sure.
We started at the end. Let's go back to the beginning and chart your course through this, because perhaps by telling your personal story, you might be able to humanize and identify some of the points you're trying to make. Would mm-hmm. that be okay?
Absolutely.
So tell us, who were you at age 18?
I feel like I was a young, lost soul. I was at 17 years old. So first of all, I haven't seen my father since I was 14. At 17, my mom remarried and moved out of state. And about a month later, I was basically kicked out of my home. I lived homeless for nearly a year. I slept in cars, parks, houses, friends' couches, like wherever I could. And I remember turning 18 as homeless. And I allowed those circumstances to get the best of me in terms of moving my morals into a different space that I was. I feel like I grew up a good kid. I always like to say I went from an 8-year-old Little League baseball player to an 18-year-old with a life sentence. And so where was the emotional trauma that was unprocessed? Where was the grief there? What happened? Where was the unmet? Where were the unmet needs that were never addressed in school or at home? And so at 18 years old, I feel like if you were to ask my family, ask my other loved ones, I mean, sense of humor, funny, love sports, you know, give the shirt off my back. But then there was this hurt side, too, to where I could be selfish and I could go get what I want. And so at 18, and I'm going to probably go into kind of what happened briefly. This is never easy for me to share. But when I was 18... A friend who I was living with at that time asked for me to commit a robbery. The idea was to take $1,000 worth of weed from this young man at that time. No guns, no knives, no weapons were supposed to be used. The plan was, in a fake drug deal, once he hands it to me, that I would run into a car and the driver would drive off. And so I admitted, I said, yes, I'll do this. So I planned the robbery, and I said, okay, as soon as he hands it to me, I'll run in a car. And we didn't have a car at that time, so a friend of mine called a driver to be the getaway driver. And unfortunately, when I did commit this robbery, when the young man came down, my co-defendant, who was the driver, I found out later, because I did not know him at that time. I found out later that he suffered from bipolar schizophrenia, and he wasn't taking his medication. And so he ended up stabbing and killing the young man. And the next morning, I had no idea someone had lost their life. And the next morning when I was told by the detective that a young man lost his life, I mean, I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't believe that that happened. It was just very unbelievable to me, and it was shocking. Mm-hmm. And so if I could just bring in context, like the law, when I went to trial, I was not on trial for a murder. My trial literally started off with the district attorney saying that this man here is not the murderer. And he told the jury, so basically the jury's job was to find me guilty for an intent to commit a robbery. So that's what the felony murder law was about. So the 12 jurors, their job was to find me guilty of an intent to commit a robbery, which I was absolutely guilty of and am still. And they found me guilty of that. Their job was done. The jury was gone. And then the next phase was with the judge, which was a mandatory sentence. And now the judge's job was to hand me a 25 to life sentence. So once the jury found me guilty of an intent to commit a robbery, then the judge had to hand me down a 25 to life mandatory sentence under the felony murder law, under the then felony murder law.
And what did you think of that at that time? Did you get how unfair it was, or what were you feeling?
I mean, in my heart, I kept saying, like, you know, I know what my intent was to commit a robbery. But I also felt really, really, and still do, you know, I know the law says otherwise, but I really feel accountable and responsible for that night completely. It bugs me. I have guilt. I have remorse for it every day. I pray literally every day for forgiveness and, you know, for the well-being of the people harmed. And so that's never forgotten on me. And it never was while I was inside. And I think a lot of that guilt, that it drove me to do what I'm doing today. I definitely believe that mass incarceration exists. I have my politics around that because I see the unfairness of people not receiving healing and people being put into cells that continue to not receive any healing. And that's why I do the work that I do. And the reason that I committed my crime is because of the lack of healing that I had. And so that's why I'm very pro-rehabilitation. But I do find myself and hold myself accountable for everything.
And so it sounds like you really found a place where you knew it was important for you to heal, and you went after opportunities that would allow you to do that. And I want to hear more about that because I think that's the kind of the crux of what you're trying to do and the message you're trying to get out there. But first, I want to reintroduce this program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing why rehabilitation in prison matters with our guests Adnan Khan, co-founder of Restore Justice and the first incarcerated person released under the new felony murder rule known as SB 1437. And we're also joined by Alex Malik, co-founder and executive director of Restore Justice. And of course, we invite you, our listeners now, to join in with your questions and comments. You can dial 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Do you feel like too many or too few resources are being used on our incarcerated population? And how do you think we should be treating people who are in prisons? Again, 866-798-TALK, or you can post a comment at the KLW website or on our Facebook page. So, Adnan, I want to go back to the story. So, you had 16 years before you released. You didn't know that that's how much time you'd be there because you thought we were going to be there 25 years to life. So how did what was your long view of what it meant to try to make sense of, to make peace with, to atone for, to heal when you didn't know that you would ever be out?
I think the most important thing for me was to heal myself. And I know that in itself started the amends for me, right? I can't speak for the people that were harmed or other survivors out there. But for me, the most important thing was find healing for myself and find empathy for myself. I realized that I used to grow up thinking as a teenager, I don't care about anyone. But what I was really telling myself, I didn't care about myself. And so that's where the healing started. That's where the conversations around my accountability for myself started. very early on. However, the prisons and the jails that I was at didn't provide any type of programming. They didn't provide any type of assistance. So I had to take it kind of upon myself to learn and reflect and understand empathy, understand forgiveness with myself, understand what accountability meant. And then to just educate myself, they didn't have college programs. I didn't have a high school diploma coming in. I was a high school dropout. The last grade I completed was 11th grade. So I did, while I was in county jail, receive my high school diploma. But after that, there wasn't anything else provided in terms of programming or healing. And so I remember when I was in this maximum security prison, my cellmate and I, we used to, these long institutional lockdowns, we used to put quotes and sayings and like wise words all over the walls, and we used to use our deodorant and shampoo labels as stickers or as tape, because we would not allow tape, and different little pieces of paper that we would find or rip up, or like lunch bags, paper lunch bags or white lunch bags, we would rip up and put those quotes on and tip them all over our wall, because we were tired of either watching the same basic couple of TV channels or staring at blank walls through 24-hour lockdowns that lasted sometimes 6 months. In a cell, 24 hours, 7 days a week. And I realize now, like, that was our way of, like, yelling for an education or yelling for programming and help and assistance and growing, but it wasn't provided. I'm just very thankful that I felt like I was protected, in a sense, spiritually, and I was around a lot of people who wanted the same thing, even though that prison did not, at that time, didn't provide that.
So then you found your way. Somehow you got to San Quentin. How did that happen, by the way?
So there's a point system, and based on good behavior, your point system would drop. So the reason I was sent to a maximum security prison, according to a quote-unquote risk assessment, I was 18 when I committed my crime, so that gave me points. The higher points you have, the higher security level you go to. So, and this is what the risk assessment said. I was 18 when I committed my crime, extra points. I had 25 to life, extra points. I didn't have a high school diploma coming into my county jail, though I had it while my risk assessment was being taken, extra points. I wasn't married or had kids, extra points. I wasn't in the military, extra points. So all those quote-unquote risk factors said that I was a danger to not the general population, because I'm in public, but to the guys inside. And so all dangerous people that fall under that criteria go to maximum security prisons. So how I got to San Quentin was almost 11 years into my incarceration, and that was through good behavior, if that's a common term, to where I stayed disciplinary free, and I went to a different prison in Solano, which was a lower-level prison than Corcoran, which was a maximum security prison I was. And then from there, again, good behavior, and then I went down to San Quentin.
And then how did you and Alex meet?
We met because I was volunteering at San Quentin at the time for a youth lifer program called KidCat, and that's how we met. And then the rest is history, I guess.
So say more. What were you there to do, and how did your role kind of and your relationship with Adnan evolve?
So what I was there to do was to help the program and provide support for the juvenile and youth lifers, and Adam was one of them. And we were organizing at the time a symposium with survivors of crime, so victims of crime, people who've lost loved ones, and district attorneys and incarcerated men to be in conversation to do a restorative justice talk in small circles, small intimate circles. So that's through that work, that's how Adnan and I started working together, and that's when we decided that we wanted to co-found Restore Justice. And then from there, Adnan and I also co-founded a media project in San Quentin called First Watch, but I'll let him talk about that.
I want to get you to say more about restorative justice. That's a term I think that maybe people have heard about, but I don't know if they actually know the details of, or at least how it was applied in the settings you were in. Who wants to take that?
I mean, generally what we have right now is a very punitive system, a punitive approach to when an offense has taken place. What restorative practices do is, restorative practices first and foremost provide healing for the person who was harmed, survivors or victims of crime, and also healing for the person who has done the harm. And in restorative practices, it is believed that healing is the number one thing, and that is what drives people to commit crimes and have these unprocessed emotions and griefs and unprocessed healings and unprocessed traumas. And when a person is harmed, that's that thing is perpetuated. Those emotions sometimes are either birthed or perpetuated in the person. So, like, there's a very common saying that says, hurt people, hurt people. And healed people, heal people. And so that was a very, basically, the probably a great quote that surmises everything about restorative practices. And so that's something that we want to do. We want to provide healing for both parties and then eventually, like, bring people together in a community sense. Because today, with the abuse of police brutality, with the distrust of government, with law enforcement, I mean, district attorneys, all of that, like, the community does not believe in people that are right now in authority. The community wants something else. The community wants restorative practices. Again, Michelle Alexander, I was reading earlier this thing she wrote for the New York Times, the author of New Jim Crow. She mentioned that, I think the survey that they took, they asked 90% of the people that they asked who were harmed, hey, what would you rather have? Would I have this person go to prison and be punished? Would you rather have punishment or restorative practices? And 90% said restorative practices. Mm-hmm. So the community is talking. We want healing. And so that's the essence of restorative justice, is an idea of where everyone can find betterment emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually. And that's lacking in our this punitive criminal justice system that we have currently today.
Mm. Were you given the opportunity to meet with survivors of the person who was...
I did not. So one thing we do understand that it's that both sides have to be ready, whatever that means. And so, again, traditionally right now where we're at, that two sides are kept apart. What I have done is multiple occasions that have been very, very powerful for me personally in my growth is sit with surrogate survivors and surrogate victims of crime and them share their story, what happened to them. And I share my story, or the men and women around me share their story, what they did. And in a sense, in the weird way, man, I know it sounds crazy, but that is what's provided a lot of healing for, at least in those circumstances that I can speak of.
Mm. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're just hearing there from Anand Khan, co-founder of Restore Justice and the first person who was incarcerated to be released under the new felony murder rule, SB 1437, just a couple of months ago, January of this year.
45 days ago.
45 days ago, not even 2 months. And Alex Malik, co-founder and executive director of Restore Justice. We have a couple of phone lines open if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255, as we talk about how rehabilitation in prison matters. You can also tweet us at CityVisionsKALW. So we have an email from Katie saying, if you could change one thing about the experience while in prison, what would you change to make the experience more humane for others?
Get rid of prisons and start doing restorative practices. The prisons are not right now, the ones I left, they're not built to have restorative practices of healing, though they'll have programs inside prison, which are very, very, very important. I definitely want to advocate for rehabilitative programs and college programs inside prison. However, the other side of that is it's a very abusive culture of power and control. And so I can go into a self-help group where I'm expected to talk about my innermost shame, traumas, hurts and pains, crime. And I'm supposed to heal that part of me. But as soon as I step out of this room, I'm being told to get against the wall, strip out, go over here, go over there, get down, get up, go to chow, come back, shower, get out of the shower. I mean, so how do you find healing in that type of culture? Mm-hmm. So people do, don't get me wrong, but it's not holistic in that sense. And so one thing I would change is get rid of that abusive culture of power and control.
Mm. How about you, Alex? What would you change?
Well, I mean, I would change sentencing, first of all.
So that people don't...
Well, no, I just think that it's... I think that programming is really important. It's key. And I think that restorative practices are important as well. But how do we expect... I think that it takes a tremendous amount of strength for someone who's sentenced, let's say, under the three strikes law, 200 years, for example, to find permanent healing in prison. I mean, yes, they can take every single program. They can take all the college courses. But in the end of the day, they're still serving 200 years. We have a person in San Quentin named Fanon, and he did something that he shouldn't have done. He committed a crime. He robbed a McDonald's. And under the three strikes law, he was sentenced to 200 years. And he's already served over 20 years in prison. So he does amazing things inside. He preaches in church. He advocate. He mentors youth, at-risk youth who come inside through the Squires program. He's done college courses. He's done incredible things, but he's 2 decades in prison. So how do we reconcile that? I mean, there has to be a reckoning with our really, really draconian sentencing laws, along with prison reform, before we can really find true healing as Californians.
That's right. So it's changing how people get there to begin with, mm-hmm. and then how they're treated once they get there.
And then once they get out, the reentry part is huge. I mean, people blame recidivism on many things, but the truth is that when we can't talk about recidivism unless we talk about reentry, which means housing and employment. So when these returning human beings, returning neighbors come back into the communities, the resources aren't there. They're still treated as the person who committed the crime years ago.
Can I interrupt?
Yes, absolutely.
I just always find it very interesting how people are so quick to blame. They'll blame the programming. They'll blame the prison system. But what we really need to hold accountable is ourselves, mm-hmm. our community. We create so many laws out of fear that create barriers for people to reenter the community, and then we don't even hold ourselves accountable. So not only has someone been shut out and kept away from society for 20-something years, and then when they come in, they can't live certain places, they can't get supportive housing, they can't get health care, and they can't afford, they can't even get a job. And there's no public transportation on top of that. So, I mean, there's just so many different ways. I mean, when someone gets out, they get $200 gate money, which hasn't changed since the 1970s. I think we do to with inflation, it would be like about $1,300 today, $1,200, which would actually help someone getting out of prison. So they get $200 gate money. It's on a kind of a debit card, and there's a fee for it, to activate it. So let's say you get $189. What do you do next?
Dollar menu at McDonald's for sure.
So I want to get to a couple of callers. Let's go first to Maya in San Francisco. Maya, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
I just wanted to first commend and just show my respect and appreciation for sharing your story and being so honest about everything that happened.
Thanks, Maya.
And I really wanted to, it's unfortunate, but like the 13th Amendment is, still really real. Mm-hmm. I'm a teacher at a middle school in San Francisco, and I feel like it's really important to make your story a lot closer, because things like this happen to be like at a distance, as you all just mentioned. And I really appreciate you for making it, a lot more real so that we can start humanizing this distant issue, right? Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to know if you had anything that you could say to the young people or teachers or even administration and an educational community, like what message would you have for us?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Maya. I appreciate that. It's funny that I've been asked that question a lot, that what would you tell the young people, first of all? And the most interesting thing that I find is that it's not what I would tell the young person. It's me listening to what the young person would tell me. I just recall as a teenager, everywhere I went, someone that was quote-unquote an adult. And by the time I was a teenager, I mean, at 12 years old, I stopped trusting adults because of my prior history with, adults, I guess. And so every time I would try to talk, I would be either not heard or listened to, and I would just be talked down to or talked at. And so I just stopped listening, because I wasn't being heard. And so it doesn't matter what I would say to a youngster right now. It's more so what the youngster would tell me. So just to have an ear open and listen, ask questions, not for us, but for them. And let them know that you care about them. As far as the administrators and teachers, I hate to say this, some teachers are just sometimes just there for the paycheck. And then I also understand it can be very overwhelming. Teachers are not parents. There isn't a community aspect in schools. It's more like administrative. Okay, I'm the teacher. Yes, there may be familiarity. A lot of teachers love their students. That does happen. But it sometimes resembles prison. A lot of you had that school-to-prison pipeline concept. A kid messes up in school, and that kid gets punished for, throwing something. And all that kid is telling you is that, hey, I'm hurt. There's something going on at home. I'm being bullied. I'm being abused. That's what that kid is telling you by throwing a piece of paper across the room. That's what that kid is telling you when he sits in the back or she sits in the back with a hoodie over their head and has an attitude towards you. They're saying that, hey, I'm hurt. There's something going on with me. But what do? We punish them. We send them to the principal's office. We put them in detention. We suspend them. And we literally take the child out of a classroom where literally their future depends on them being in a classroom, right? And so there's many, many things I would tell like administrators is to practice more community, practice more restorative justice. Don't be a teacher. You can't be a parent. I understand like the legal logistics of that. But be an auntie then, right? Be a grandmother, be an uncle, you know. Be that type of person in that child's life and listen.
Thanks so much, Maya, for your call. Alex, have you thought, you at Anon and others with Restore Justice, thought about bringing this message not only to school children but to school districts about what needs to happen at the school level to also change the trajectory that unfortunately many children, especially children of color, are on?
Yes, we really have. It's actually something that Anon is really passionate about, and I'll let him say a couple words about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I want to get more into since I've been out. It's been, what, 44, 45 days since I've been out. And one of the biggest things is understanding that. So we have like a advisory board or coalition of formerly incarcerated people out here, men and women. A lot of times women get left out in this conversation. But and what we want to do is, and what we're doing is in schools to, first of all, have formerly incarcerated people go into schools and talk to the youth there. And be open and have an open conversation about what happened and why it happened and not hide the fact that formerly incarcerated people and currently incarcerated people are human beings and to show the humanity. That's one, to establish empathy. The second thing I think I would say is that we need to put emotional intelligence courses and classes in school. As an 8-year-old, when my parents divorced, I didn't know how to process that grief. How does an 8-year-old know how to process trauma? So then I'm put into school where I'm supposed to learn academic intelligence, science, and history about Christopher Columbus, you know. And here my parents were divorced, and I'm supposed to learn about Christopher Columbus. It just didn't connect with me at that time. And so I think what we need to do is, yes, share this message of incarceration, humanization, but also emotional intelligence classes and restorative justice practices in schools.
Let's go next to Ariana in San Francisco. Did I get your name right?
Thank you.
Hi there.
I wrote my dissertation on mass incarceration and prison reentry, and I really very, very much appreciate your guests. I just want to make a few comments because I can't say as much as I'd like to, and they've said it better than I could in many ways. But I think it's really important to understand not only that schools can't be responsible, teachers cannot be responsible for all the trauma that their children have that come into the classroom, but that environments that we under-resource or under-fund not only show respect for human life, but they beget certain acts of violence. So trauma is actually stored in environments,
mm-hmm.
and gets replicated and imitated in those environments generationally. And one way of thinking about violence is that someone who physically or emotionally abuses another person is trying to work with their own overwhelming sense of chaos. So they try to control others or have power over others because they feel out of control. And so, unfortunately, that's why sometimes prison offers containment for some people, and for other people it just totally breaks them. And, you know, it's just like crushing. And so what I think is needed is to understand that not all human beings are going to be labor units that are going to provide something to further perhaps like certain capitalistic aims in our society. And then to go back and understand the essential spiritual aspects of all people. When we leave out the spiritual from our which includes the community, but from our prisons, from our institutions, from our schools, we fail to understand that we need to revere and honor all people and that we have to invest, and that means invest liberally instead of allowing a certain small group of people to sequester a huge amount of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? We cease having a civilization.
Thank you so much, Ariana, for your call. I want to get one more caller in, and then we'll get some more responses from you, Adnan and Alex. Let's go to Winston in Fremont. Winston, welcome to the program.
Hey, yeah. I just wanted to say that I think the caller before me just mentioned that it's more about now is about prisons for profit. As long as privatized prisons are allowed to exist and operate, we're never going to have a system of rehabilitation. It's all an illusion. We live in a system now where basically your prisoners are going in to a privatized institution. They're working for a few cents on the dollar. They're giving that all that profit to Target and Walmart, which is basically just a huge cyclical basis. I mean, we're just basically the revolving door. It seems to be the system we live in now. It's not about ever going to be rehabilitation as long as it's always about the almighty dollar and using humans as slave labor. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Great point. I have a lot to say about that, but great
yeah.
point.
So, Alex and then Adnan, you want to respond to the last couple of calls we got? Oh, they keep pointing back and forth at each other. Flip a coin.
Are we talking about prison privatization and people for profit? Well, I mean, I know that I agree. I think that paying people cents on the dollar is completely inhumane, and I mean, it just goes to how we dehumanize people once they're incarcerated. We keep them away from their families, away from society, and then we call them by their prison number, by their CDC, their California Department of Rehabilitation, Corrections and Rehabilitation number. So, and they call each other by their last name. They're called inmate instead of person. Whenever there's headlines, it's murderer or a thief or robber. So, yes, I mean, it's all...
Yeah, the labeling is absolutely terrible. The labeling is absolutely terrible. I think that when it comes to, like, the last caller was talking about having incarcerated people as basically pieces of assets, right, is very true. So I remember when I was in San Quentin, or really anywhere, but I'll talk about San Quentin, for example. Just got there. It was like they got 70-plus self-help groups programs. Just joined the college classes, getting on my way to get a degree. And I don't have a job assignment because I'm doing the programs. I come back to my cell one night, and on my bunk, there's this job assignment card. And doing time in prison, I know exactly what that means. That means that I have been assigned to a job. Jobs take priority over any rehabilitative group, whether you want a job or not. And it's very hard to get out of a job. You can probably transfer to another assignment, but very hard to get out of a job. So I ended up working in the kitchen for 8 cents an hour. I also owed restitution, which is victim fees or court fees, and which meant that they took 55% of everything I earned, which meant they took 55% of the 8 cents. So I would end up getting, I like to say, is 3 cents and some change an hour, if that makes any sense. And I would work in the kitchen for 6, 7, 8 hours. And I had to put my programs and my college classes on hold because I can't be two places at one time. And my thing is, like, when did incarcerated people become workers? Like, when did we become workers? Why is it okay for when you put person in a cage for doing something wrong to make them laborers and workers? And then next thing you know, 8 cents an hour, a lot of jobs are zero. I mean, you work your butt off, and you don't get paid anything. But you're forced to go to work, and work takes priority over any rehabilitative group.
So I know that, that Alex, you're saying that there needs to be a lot of sentencing reform, and we'll touch to that in a moment. But how is this transformation of the culture inside and the dialogue, if there can be one, between corrections and inmates or people who are incarcerated and advocates for bumping up the amount of rehabilitation? How can that happen? How does it happen? Has it started anywhere? Do we have examples of that?
That's a tough one. How do you change a culture, right? Especially one that's driving money for a state, right? How do you get rid of prisons when prisons are located in California, for the most part, in rural areas, right? So the first place I went to was Corcoran, middle of nowhere. People never heard of a place called Corcoran before. And so the surrounding towns and the neighborhoods, they become correctional officers or nurses or cooks or administrative staff. And so now there's this whole economy being provided where there's prisons. So how do you tell all of those people, hey, we need more rehabilitation. We need to get rid of your job. We need to get rid of this prison. You need to go find something else to do. That is very hard to do when you talk about someone's livelihood. And then you're talking about collaboration with, okay, we need to move towards rehabilitation. But then you have the other side that, no, we need to punish. And how do you find a common ground? And is there a common ground in the work that we do? I mean, I don't know. You know, that's a tough one. How do you find collaboration?
Right. It sounds like there's a fundamental conflict of interest that hasn't been resolved here, because there's yeah. a whole industry, yeah. as people call it, and
I mean,
that depends on this continuing to happen. And you're talking about solutions that would either keep people from coming back, recidivism, or shorten the times that they spend there to
but
begin with.
This is also not to say that we haven't had collaborations. I mean, we do have wonderful programs on level four yards in California, and we do and we are allowed to do a lot of really, really transformative, amazing work inside prisons. So, I mean, it's twofold. It's changing a culture. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated. I mean, it's a huge industry. I mean, and we also have to look about how us as Californians, how we're complicit in this. I mean, all of our state furniture, all of our furnitures and dorms in California are created by incarcerated people. Our license plates are created by are made by incarcerated people, cents on the dollar. I mean, in many ways, our state is really dependent on incarcerated labor. We saw that during the fires.
So we just have about 5 or 6 minutes left to the program. I want to hear about next steps for Restore Justice. You obviously had this huge success with SB 1437, and you mentioned some things about sentencing reform. Can you talk to us, Alex, about what's next on your list of things to accomplish here to achieve criminal justice reform?
Sure. So we're going to continue pushing legislation in California. We're really excited about our restorative justice pilot program. Mm-hmm. We just introduced legislation that we're supporting. What number is it again?
Senate Bill 678.
And Adnan, can you talk a little bit
about
that?
Oh, yeah, a little bit about that. I am very excited about this. And so when we talk about changing the system from this mass incarceration, what this restorative justice bill would do would, first of all, have people, it's not about not going to prison, but find healing for the parties involved. The Restorative Justice Bill will be a pilot program in 3 counties. And what it'll do is, it'll, first of all, with consent of the survivor, the person harmed, consent of the responsible party, and consent with the district attorney to have this restorative justice practice instead of punitive approach, send him or her to prison to find healing for both sides, and they eventually have a restorative justice dialogue and healing and making direct amends and indirect amends. So indirect amends is, for example, I committed a crime and I help the youth out, or I go volunteer in the community, I go plant flowers. You know, all those are great indirect amends that try to atone for the harm that I've done to the person indirectly. Direct amends is to the person you've harmed. And so this will have an aspect of both. And the Restorative Justice Pilot Program will not send people to prison, but will provide an avenue for safety, first and foremost, public safety, but healing for all sides involved.
Hmm. What else is on your agenda?
We're also looking at parole reform, but I can't really talk too much about that. But California has really horrible, abysmal parole grant rates for lifers. If we had longer, I'm sure Adnan would love to talk about how what that means to have a life sentence in California. And then big picture, we'd love to do something about three strikes. When we talk about the man who's sentenced to 200 years. I mean, 3 strikes isn't over in California, and there's that misconception.
And why is there that misconception?
Well, I mean, it was highly publicized. People thought it was over when there was a Prop 36, but it's not over. And a lot of people who had violent crimes or violent strikes, they're not included, and they're still stuck in prison. And there's a lot of stories about the guy who robbed the McDonald's who are serving, you know, just disproportionate sentences, who are just stuck and have no opportunity for relief beyond a commutation.
How about bail reform? Can you say more about that? And of course, this is a series, so we don't have to get into all of those things. Is that something you're working on?
No, that's not something mm-hmm. that we're working on.
Okay. And community has been brought up many times here in the conversation tonight. What is the power that hasn't been tapped in the community voice to make some of these changes actually happen? And specifically within that community, the community of survivors of crimes, have you had a sense that there's an alliance there that can be formed to really flip the dynamic and change the narrative on this?
I mean, I will say the ones that I've personally worked with, Alex and I have personally worked with, there are many, many survivors that want to do this type of work. I can name a few. I don't want to put their names out there. I want to make sure that there's consent. But there's several, and I don't want to even say several, there's plenty of people who have been harmed by violence and crime that want to do this work with people who have done the harm. So there is like a coalition. There is this huge team. We're up and down California. There's plenty across the state. And so the people, it is the people that are asking for this type of change.
Mm. And Alex, what can listeners who may be motivated and inspired by hearing these stories tonight, your story, Adnan's story, what can they do to become part of a change process here?
Well, they can check out our website, restorecal.org, and they can go up to Sacramento. I mean, people's voices in California, they matter. Assembly members and senators, they listen to people in their district. So if someone's interested in legislation that organizations are pushing, making a phone call to your assembly member or your senator, that makes a huge difference. If they know that the community is behind them, then they'll take more risks and support bold legislation.
And I just want to hurry up and throw this in there. Vote for progressive DAs. I hate using that term, progressive DAs, district attorneys. But I think when in our communities, when it is up to the district attorney, like Alex was saying, to whether they want to charge someone, not press charges, charging to the fullest extent of the law, to offer a plea deal, or to practice restorative justice. We look at mass incarceration. You can look at the funnel to mass incarceration is district attorneys. And so I really, really, really want to tell the public locally, study and vote for progressive district attorneys that want restorative practices in your communities.
So Adnan, obviously you started this work before you were released 45 days ago. What's next for you with this kind of work, but also in general in a life that you couldn't envision just 45 days ago?
There's several things, man. I mean, definitely want to continue doing this work. I just came back from a 4-day trip in Sacramento at the Capitol, where I met the governor, Governor Newsom. I was able to sit and talk with the California Department of Corrections Rehabilitation. Met with a lot of Sanders Assembly members who voted yes on 1437, the bill that got me out, and actually thanked them, like sit face to face and say, hey, thank you for voting yes on this bill that got me out and many more behind me. So I want to continue doing that work, reach into the juvenile halls, start to do that, and in the schools as well. The other thing completely on the side, when I was in San Quentin, with Alex, we founded this media project called First Watch, where we it was all incarcerated men from pre-production and post-production. We would film, like we were, imagine incarcerated people walking around our prison with cameras and filming life. And so those are on our website as well. The videos, there's about 30, 40 videos that I did with a group of First Watch guys who still exist inside San Quentin now. And out here, so what I want to do is continue doing the filmmaking work, the narrative of, imagine a movie being made or videos being made by the people directly impacted. One example I like to use is, imagine journalism about the Warriors from Steph Curry. Right? Mm-hmm. Instead of like this outside journalist coming in doing stories on the Warriors, Steph Curry is the journalist filming everything, recording everything, getting interviews himself because he's part of the Warriors. So the same thing with us. That's what we're going to do with First Watch out here, show you more videos of formerly incarcerated people and the great work we're doing out here.
Wow. Well, I'm so honored that you'd spend your 45th or 46th day, an hour of it, with us here tonight. So I want to thank you, Adnan Khan, co-founder of Restore Justice and the first incarcerated person released under the new felony murder rule, SB 1437, and Alex Malik, co-founder and executive director of Restore Justice. Thanks, you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, KLW.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next week as we look at the conflicts around privacy and people who use social media. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.